Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Ahoy, and thank you for listening to the biggest, greatest, most important episode of FlixWise ever. I'm the captain of this ship, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And on deck with me here in Madison, Wisconsin, with her napkin placed just so, is my fellow UW grad student, Leah Stoyer. Welcome, Leah.
I want you to crowd me like one of your French girls. Wearing this. Wearing only this.
Yay. Okay. And joining us from across the ocean is broad European stereotype, Miss Emily Monti. Welcome, Emily.
I'm ready to take a journey on the ship of dreams.
Beautiful.
This is
so sexy.
Oh, my God. This is going to go well. Okay. Finally, rounding out our illustrious panel is a woman who writes film reviews like a man. Well, let's welcome to the show, Kristen Lopez.
I unfortunately cannot ride a horse with one side saddle or one leg on each side, so I feel like this movie's not made for me.
Nonsense. This movie is for everybody.
It is for everybody, but okay. Not for horseback riding girls who are in wheelchairs, so James Cameron is kind of a dick.
Yeah.
Wow, coming in hot.
I know. I didn't have a bit prepared. I just went with it.
I love it. Okay. On today's show, we have romance, adventure,
Celine Dion,
feminism, your friend Billy Zane. And really, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
God.
All right. Okay. Yeah, we're doing Titanic, everyone, in case that's not perfectly obvious. This is a brand new panel. I think this is everyone's debut appearance on FlixWise. So, way to start things off with a bang, guys. I don't know. This is a high-pressure situation, I have to say. Like, I've been waiting to do this show basically since the beginning of this podcast. And I'm so glad it's finally come to pass. So, without further ado, Emily, I think, are you ready?
Yeah, I am ready.
Let's do this.
You know.
Okay, all right. So Emily's gonna do the honors and tell us why she thinks James Cameron's 1997 Best Picture winner is one of the greatest films of all time. Okay, should I give this line? Should I do it?
Do it.
Do it.
Are you guys ready for a real podcast?
Yes, in fact, I am ready.
All right, Emily, take it away.
I have to say, as a 13-year-old girl, I felt both embarrassed and enraptured by the unabashed sentimentality of Titanic. And although I mercilessly made fun of this movie, I also secretly rented the soundtrack to it from the library and memorized every song on it, and definitely saw this movie in the cinemas more than once. And then it was a great many years before I returned to Titanic. It wasn't as many years as the illustrious submarine treasure hunters spent before they returned to Titanic. But I did return to the movie 1 year ago from some strange impulse, and actually discovered that Titanic is not all about the sentimentality that we remember from our childhood. I was impressed by the flawless structure that is so organically woven into the script. I would maybe exclude the dialogue from the term flawlessness, but the structure actually synthesizes theme and plot very nicely. And it, even though it hinges on teenage emotions, they are really psychologically quite real. And it also blends the epic and the personal journeys together quite well, I think. So it it has a lot of very interesting things going for it in all those ways. It is also kind of structurally interesting because it is more of a two-act structure than the normal Hollywood three-act structure. It foregrounds this love story romance for an hour and 30 minutes while you kind of feel the tension of the shipwreck building. And then for the last hour and 30 minutes, it's a real-time disaster movie that is completely anxiety producing and heart stopping. So I would like to submit that Titanic has all these hallmarks of a truly memorable movie that is a lot more than sentimentality. And that's why I think it should be added to the FlixWise favorites list.
Okay, beautiful way to bring that around. Okay. So I don't know if we need a synopsis, but we should probably maybe just throw one out there.
Do it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there was this ship called the Titanic, and it sank.
The end.
The end. Death.
Spoilers.
But I don't know. You kind of alluded to... what's that?
Spoilers much.
Yeah. Well, Emily, you kind of alluded to the sort of structure of the movie and how it kind of... It sort of it kind of dances around the kind of historical narrative, you sort of like, as dismissive as maybe or defensive as we may be about the sentimentality, I do think that's a huge component of the film, right? So it's kind of about these callous treasure hunters, as you call them, going and mining the Titanic for capital gain, right? Or for whatever treasures they might find, right? Without taking into account that there were real people with real stories mm-hmm. who died on that ship, right? Mm-hmm. And that is what the movie's about, I think, right? Okay, but I think, before we get into it, let's just, I think, go around the table and talk about when we first saw it and what it meant to us at the time and what it means to us now. So, Leah, do you want to start us off? When did you first see this movie?
I first saw Titanic. I was explicitly banned from seeing it in theaters in 1997 because mm-hmm. I was in third grade. And I think my mom had, like, gotten wind of the sexual content.
Mm-hmm.
So I was...
Yeah, Emily, where were the boobs in your synopsis?
You know what? I'll add them in right now. Because yeah. there were boobs. Mm-hmm. So, she knew there were boobs there, and I was not allowed to see boobs. Mm-hmm. Or all the other things that go along with boobs, sexual awakening.
Mm-hmm.
So I was feeling really left out of the whole kind of, like, Leo-gasm that sloped the country, and I really wanted to see it. So I saw it for the first time in my friend Andrea's bedroom, probably in 1998 when it was out on video. And what I remember was, A, being really traumatized by the scene where they... You see all the dead bodies in the water, mm-hmm. like, after, you know, like, is there anyone out there? So that really stuck with me. But the feeling of tension in the room with all these third grade girls watching, like, the scene in the car mm-hmm. and being what is this? And my dad drove me home from Andrea's house that day, and I was feeling so guilty because I had seen this movie against my parents' wishes. And I remember looking at the window of the car and remembering Kate Winslet's hand slapping against the window, and I was so overcome with guilt. And I was like, Dad, I saw Titanic. I saw Titanic in Andrea's house. I'm so sorry. And he was like, okay, why didn't you see it in theaters? I was like, because Mom wasn't letting me. But... Oh. Yeah, I mean, it was worth it. Saw it with friends, was very affected,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Big moment in
mm-hmm.
third grade.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful story. I'm guessing that we all have stories that are similar to that, right?
I mean,
yeah, just like a mix
of... My mom was pretty cool, so...
Okay.
I had the weird mom that would let me see... With the exception of, like, Pulp Fiction, I saw American Beauty the year it came out, and I think I was only about 10. So my mom was weird. So I remember going to see this with my mom and my cousin, who was a boy, for clarity's sake, and my little brother, who was literally, I think, about 2 months old. And I feel like they were the worst people to go see this movie with because mm-hmm. my cousin didn't care, and he was bored. and my mom was like nursing intermittently throughout the film, and it was just me. So I feel like I kind of missed something. It wasn't until I got the two VHS set.
Iconic, that yes.
I watched it like all the time, and I was thinking this movie is the best thing ever. I could quote it. In the scene where they're gonna get pulled under the water, I would try to hold my breath as long as they did. And I think that is movie magic because I was unable to do it. So yeah, it's like the linchpin. I think I don't want to say it's the movie that made me appreciate movies, but as an adult, I think it did.
Yeah. Okay, Emily, how about you?
You know, I remember seeing it in the theater with my cousin, who was equally into it. And it was just like, it was the thing to see. It was the movie to see at that time. I was probably like 13, and it was very easy to get things past my mother because she was unaware of the content of movies. So I think
so jealous.
she was like, why is it rated PG-13? And I would say like, oh, I don't know, I think it's fine. And she'd be like, okay.
All right. Yeah. My parents were definitely not very lax, and yet somehow they let this one slide because I think it fell under the rubric of like history lesson, right?
Totally. Yeah.
So this one got a pass. Plus, this is probably like too much family history for you all, but my mother listened to Dennis Prager obsessively, and she still does, who is someone I generally find reprehensible, but he endorsed the movie despite the sexual content. He's like a conservative radio talk show host.
Wow.
Yeah, and so I somehow managed to go see this in theaters, not once, but twice. And I think it was, looking back, it's probably one of the most formative experiences of my whole life. I had to like leave the theater for the drawing scene.
Wow.
It was like I couldn't.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I just
too
looked
much.
Away.
Yeah.
It's like, so interesting how all these stories involve like the mom's presence, because you know, central relationship between Rose and her mom.
Ah, thank
really.
You so much.
You're
yes.
welcome. Yeah. For calling it back to the structure of the movie.
Yeah, I guess we should probably talk about it as a movie. And that's kind of ultimately my aim for doing this podcast, is because I do feel like so much of the discourse surrounding this movie is about people's reactions to it. And it's never it's about people's nostalgia for the era or for whatever. Like, because it is such a... I think it's a formative movie for a lot of people, and so it calls up a lot of nostalgic feelings. But the film itself is actually really excellent. So let's talk about the framing device, right? I've actually had conversations with the producer of the co-producer of this podcast, and he thinks that the entire Brock storyline, the whole thing with Bill Paxton, needs to be excised.
Wrong.
Leah, why is that wrong?
Wrong.
Yep.
Wrong.
Yep.
First of all, excise Bill Paxton. That's insane. Why would you excise Bill Paxton from anything?
Especially from a James Cameron movie, considering
indeed,
their
he's always
long
the best
story
part.
History.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm,
I really want to know if it was his idea or Cameron's idea to do the earring, because it just slays me.
I always want to question the blonde hair. Like, that hair. What is that hair color?
It was 97. You know, like, there was a lot going on.
Choices were made.
Yeah.
It's fine. But, yeah, so why is Martin wrong? Tell Martin why he's wrong.
I feel like the Paxton framing device is really essential in looking at this movie's structure as, like, a women's film. I feel like it really puts to the forefront, like, makes us think critically about how men make women's films. Because the whole thing... Bill Paxton, Brock Lovett, an insane movie name if I ever heard one. Mm-hmm. His whole thing is he wants to, like, penetrate the Titanic. He wants to make his legacy by, like,
he needs to, like, break into this safe, find the heart of the ocean, and he's just gonna plunder, like, this history for his own
I've never realized how nasty this plot point is.
It kind of is. Like, Titanic is, like, this peaceful present, like, this female presence at the bottom of the ocean, and Brock is just like, let me get into this safe. I'll do anything I need to do.
Let me penetrate
And then, like, but then when Brock gets into the safe, like, that's when we see an even deeper, again, feminized mystery mm-hmm. of the drawing of Rose. So then Brock's like, finally, I cracked it. I gotta just find the lady who's in the drawing. But then Rose is like, how about 84 years of foreplay? And it's like just this whole thing where she says the woman's heart is a deep ocean of secrets. I feel like it's kind of about how men want to plunder, like, female stories for, like, their value, whereas women are just like, take it slow, like, see me as a human, mm-hmm. like, appreciate the human tragedy of it all. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I love that framing device. I feel like it makes it so real.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, I have a concept that might be similar to that, because I've never questioned whether the framing device is necessarily relevant or not. I just always was like, oh, it's just how the movie starts, because ordinarily you need a way to get... Because 90s movies by this point had such a kind of cool, like, extreme sports type of mentality to them. Like, you have to be able to get people in really quickly. And a period drama like this, where you're going to get the audience to, like, the mentality I'm assuming is they could fall asleep in the first 10 minutes if you get people in, like, big hats and buttoned-up collars. But to be the cynic, you could always say, it's about James Cameron himself, because most movies are about James Cameron talking about James Cameron. So, I mean, if you take it like that, because James Cameron has talked about how obsessed he is with the Titanic, and he had gone down there several times and people had called him an opportunist. So I'm almost tempted to say that, like, that's James Cameron learning about why he shouldn't be, like, a plundering douchebag, and mm-hmm. while at the same time being told this story by the woman he would leave his wife, well, not Gloria Stewart, the right. granddaughter,
yeah.
You know, having to be in the same room as the woman that he would leave his wife for. So I from that mentality, I think it's kind of like, see, people, these relics are both important and valuable, and the people that look for them are both opportunistic douches, but they're also people who want to learn more, and I am one of them because I'm James Cameron. I mean, you could go with that too. The point is, it's still necessary.
You absolutely know? Yeah. And I'm curious what you guys make of, I forget the character's name, but Brock's sidekick who wears the Watchmen t-shirt.
Bodine, Mr. Bodine.
Mr. Bodine, yes.
I literally almost said Matthew Bodine. I think his name is Louis Bodine.
Louis Bodine, okay. Because I think, what do you guys think of him as being kind of the James Cameron fanboy surrogate? Right, I think this is him saying, like, audience, I know you're skeptical. I know you're used to Terminator 2. I know you want big explosions. But I'm not going to give it to you, right? And you're like going to feel things,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and the way he explains, he, like, mansplains the Titanic sinking to Gloria Stewart. Yeah. He's like, then there's a down the middle. And she's like, thank you for that explanation. Yeah. But it was much different.
But I also think, you know, it's really a nod to the different styles of filmmaking that had come out in the late 90s. Because, you know, you look at Gloria Stewart's character, who is very emblematic of, like, golden era studio filmmaking. She's very prim and proper, and, you know, comes from this whole different style of acting. And then you have what essentially is the representative of what would become geek culture in you know, the next 10-15 years, who mm-hmm. is just, like, consumes information and then boils it down in the most brash way possible. Mm-hmm. And it's funny and it's informative, but it's also not particularly educational, but it's entertaining. So I like it from that perspective, because as filmmaking would become more CGI and, you know, emphasis on visuals as opposed to storytelling, you're kind of getting that perfect bridge between, this was our past, this is what's going on right now, and then James Cameron is predicting the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, speaking of classic Hollywood, where do you think Titanic fits in with this kind of legacy of this mode of filmmaking? Like, I think of this as being kind of the apex of this form of storytelling, and yeah, I would take this one over Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
But I don't know. So, I mean, maybe we can just talk a little bit about how it fits in and sort of some of the devices that Cameron's using that kind of directly crib from someone like David Lean and other lesser epic directors.
Well, it's fascinating to kind of look at Titanic in context, because the late 90s and 97 specifically saw a real push back to classic era Hollywood. I think of like this and LA Confidential as returning to this kind of filmmaking, either storytelling devices like Titanic does, or actually in that time period, this harkening back to studio era 1940s kind of films. And this, where LA Confidential is about that time, this is really harkening back to those specific films. And I don't really see it as kind of like the roadshow pictures, like a Dr. Zhivago or a Lawrence of Arabia, which are trying to promote kind of the political moments. You know, those two movies are very steeped in the political elements of what was going on in those time periods. This is kind of harkening back more to 1940s, like epic romantic melodramas, something like obviously the Barbara Stanwyck 1950s version, but you also have just other romantic dramas where you have two people from the opposite ends of the social strata brought together who can't be together because reasons. So from that mentality, if you're just kind of looking at it from a romantic storytelling angle, I think Cameron does a really good job. He does his homework, because you have a lot of moving parts in this movie, whether it's the relationship with the mom, or it's not just Jack and Rose, which I appreciate. So mm-hmm. I think James Cameron does a really good job of showing that he's done his homework, which is this multi-layered approach. But at the same time, if you look at 1940s melodramas of that time period, they're not nearly as story-driven. It's just kind of beautiful clothes and then conflict, or you know, the Titanic sinks. He's employing more modern storytelling devices, which is layering on these conflicts, layering on storytelling, with this big visual, you know, climax at the end. So I think, again, I hate to give Cameron too much credit, but he's really bridging the gap between acknowledging the past history of filmmaking with how to apply it to an audience that wants entertainment in 1997.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it as being kind of apolitical. But I also don't really know how it would relate. I don't know how it relates to that era. Like, this is height of 90s optimism, or is this like post tech bubble bursting, and does it serve as kind of an allegory for that?
I think it's because the 90s, I mean, the 90s are typically considered kind of a, like, innocence before technology, before the internet takes over, and you have, you know, relative economic stability. So even though Jack and Rose come from these opposite ends of their respective social bubbles, Jack, for being, you know, a homeless guy, is relatively clean, and he's, you know, he's kind of like that free white in 21 Ruby Keeler type of character, which is like, I'm not held down by the man, I'm a free spirit, and I don't need, it's a very 90s thing, like he's not about bourgeois affectations. I think he would fit right in with the cast of like Reality Bites, who don't want to work at the Gap.
Yep.
A very 90s mentality that in the early 1900s, pre-World War I and leading up to the Depression, kind of didn't exist.
It's another sort of 90s attitude that we see in spades here is the sort of like consumerist feminism or kind of the mainstream feminism.
Can I make a comment though on the last subject here?
Sure.
I think this nobility of poverty motif, yeah, is something that is very 90s and very timely, but it also ties back into the framing device. I think the framing device, where I would have agreed with Martin when I first saw this movie, I thought it was completely useless. Now seeing it again, I feel like it actually reinforces the theme of the movie, which is all about surface versus substance. The ship above the water, the ship under the water, discovering what lies beneath. The whole journey of Rose is from her inward unhappiness and her life of outwardness and luxury towards a life of inner peace, even though she's outwardly in misery and in disaster. So I think I think that also applies to the heart of the ocean, this diamond, this looking for treasure, and the sort of futility of searching for what will make you happy in the outward, and the outwardness of life, money, the you know, beauty of something that's rare and precious. And really, it's this inwardness, the self-determination, the treasure under the ocean is not this valuable jewel, it's the story that this old woman tells. So I think thematically, the framing device actually dovetails very nicely with the historical themes as well.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it sounds like you kind of buy into Cameron's worldview. I don't know. Yeah. I feel like looking back, it seems a little bit, there are certain elements of it that seem kind of 70s new agey, which I'm here for, you know.
Oh, maybe the central romance.
Yeah.
I'm saying there's great cohesion in it. I don't think you have to buy into or completely accept, you know, this is true, this is reality. Just that there's so much cohesion that makes sense together. That is what sort of makes it such a well-structured movie.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, if we're talking about James Cameron, feminist director, I think he likes to have it both ways a lot of the time. Or you think of like True Lies, which I think is the most ugly, like, I hate women's screed that he's made, because he was getting a divorce at the time. But here, what I really like is that Jack Dawson is kind of like, in 1997, he's the manic pixie dream boy, you know?
100%.
He is the guy that galvanizes the girl into action with his, like, I'm super awesome, and he is a little mansplainy at times. Like, people don't know you like I do, and you know, you're a delicate butterfly that's gonna get crushed on the wheel. But at the same time, he's kind of this sprite that comes out of nowhere that tells her, you know, I think you're awesome, and I have no real like motivations of my own or character, but I think you are just like aces. So from that,
I don't know. I have to just like, is that he has like no motivations or character?
I mean,
it's tempting to, like, think of, like, Cameron as, like, the auteur of it all, but, like, Leo DiCaprio's performance as Jack is so freaking weird. he is that Mad Fixie Dream Boy, but, like, I mean, knowing about what he originally wanted to bring to that role, he, like, wanted to play him super dark and neurotic and, like, edgy, and Cameron was like, no, maybe you could do it a little lighter.
Sure.
But he brings like such a strange kind of like energy to that performance. Like, I feel like you do get the sense, like all of his little hints about what went down in Chippewa Falls and Paris and everything. I mean, like, this guy, he does sort of wake up Kate Winslet, but I think we get the sense that he is also, you know, like the lost soul has been waiting to be woken up by her. I mean, I think part of the amazing structure of the movie is how balanced that central romance is. Like, so much energy is devoted to both of them. And I feel like both actors kind of think that they're the main character of the movie, and they play it that way, which is what makes it such an interesting push and pull. But, like, I was always really fascinated by what he brought to that role. He kind of seems like he didn't originally want to be there, but now he's here, and he's just going to kind of, like, play each line however he wants.
I think the good thing, you know, we, once again, of like the 90s apotheosis of masculinity in 97, like, his hair, the one thing I can't get over is that his hair is not period appropriate. That is a 90s haircut, man. That is not 1912, but or whatever. That's neither here nor there, because I loved it at like 9 years old. That's what I went for. Okay, him and Matt Damon. It was my thing. But considering that James Cameron originally wanted Matthew McConaughey for the role, which Matthew McConaughey, the accent would have been so distracting. But I think what makes Jack as a character and what makes Leo's performance so good is that he's a character that's not, I don't want to say non-threatening, because that's just such a modern way of looking at it. But he doesn't have this, like, he's confident, but not overly so. You know, I think if you had someone who's like Matthew McConaughey, who's just like uber laid back, you wouldn't see what would make Rose want to go for him, because, you know, you have her with the strict formality of like Billy Zane and this kind of 90s greed is good Gordon Gekko type of character that is here. And that's contrasted very nicely. I think Leo plays it where he's got a little confidence, but he's like totally terrified of women. You know, he's like, I've drawn women naked, but like women don't actually want me. Like, what is happening here? And I think that works. That works just enough that you buy the relationship. And it helps that, you know, they became good friends and they make movies together and, you know, they work really well together. So it all works out.
it's true. I still feel very attached to their friendship. Like, if it ever came out that they weren't actually friends and this whole thing has been a lie, I don't know what I would do.
No. That is,
Kate Winslet is going to have a deathbed confession where she's like, I've never liked him, ever.
Oh my God, no. Actually, I saw a tweet by Zane himself. It was like him and Kate Winslet and Leo at some environmentalist thing. He's like, no, we're saving the icebergs. I was like, oh my God, this is so good.
That's beautiful. Oh my God.
They're all friends. Even Zane.
Even Zane's allowed. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about the Kate and Leo chemistry. Because it is such a weird alchemy. Like, I remember at the time thinking, like, he looks so much younger than she does. She has this, like, she feels very kind of worldly and sophisticated, so European. And he's this dork.
He's like a man child with, like, his penchant for, like, spitting and, like, being happy. Yeah. Like, he's overly pleased by certain things. It just, you're like, are you really like a 10-year-old boy in like a 25-year-old guy's body? Like, I could believe that.
Yeah.
And yet somehow it works.
Yeah.
his star image really worked to his advantage, because that's all we had ever seen him as. It was Growing Pains, Gilbert Grape, the basketball movie, which
Basketball Diaries.
So it's that, like, youth and vulnerability and, like, not being fully formed yet that made him so appealing. It felt like we were watching at that moment that, like, he had been turned into a diamond.
Yeah.
And it also, I mean, if you look at this in, like, Romeo and Juliet, which I think came out, what, the year before?
Stay tuned, because there will be a podcast about Romeo plus Juliet.
Because as a person now with a master's in English, I can recite the first like 20 minutes of Romeo and Juliet verbatim, but I get so annoyed now watching it because Leo's recitations are not right. So he's got pauses in places that he shouldn't. And then I think he followed Titanic up with Man in the Iron Mask. So if you look at those three movies in context, Like, he was really testing how far he could push himself and then realized, no, period dramas, like, I gotta play me in some form. Titanic mm-hmm. works. Anything on either side doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Huh. So, Emily, had you seen anything with Leo before Titanic?
I think I saw Gilbert Grape later. I don't think, okay. I think this is the first time I had seen him in a movie. And okay. There's a certain weird semi-darkness that is ever so slightly below the giddiness and goofiness that really mm-hmm. works for him.
I mean, he does say that the greatest thing that ever happened to him is that he bought a ticket on a sinking ship. That's pretty dark.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a Lodon Draper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I don't know. So do we see hints of the actor to come? Or do you feel like how fully formed was the persona at this point?
I don't...
Like, has he just been kind of leaning into this for 20 years now?
No. So as somebody who went on a severe Leo binge after this movie and like bought books, like there were books that were written in the wake of this. I think this, it came immediately after, because if you know, there's always this like confidence that I think is only increased, and this need to immerse himself. If anything, I think he's been trying to pay for this movie over the years with how increasingly committed he's become to being very selective about projects and wanting to produce and all. I think like he really was terrified of becoming like a teen idol. It's almost kind of like Heath Ledger in a way. Like, both of them made these really girl-friendly movies and then felt like they had to go the complete opposite to avoid being seen as, like, teeny bopper fare. So mm-hmm. I don't think we get the Leo that would win an Oscar one day, but I think that he knew that the project was going to be, whether he says it or not, he knew that this would be the movie that would kind of springboard him.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. I mean, so that's interesting that the majority of his projects post-Titanic have been kind of a way to distance himself from this character. That seems like a shame, because I don't think he's ever been as kind of, like, light on his feet. And I think this is, like, his most joyful performance, like, and
certainly.
He's comedic. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. He's funny. Like,
in every way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of, it's not as much, like, I mean, he's really leaned into the kind of method actor, like, mm-hmm. I'm gonna hunch my shoulders and you're gonna know I'm serious, right? But what about Kate? We gotta talk about Kate.
Okay.
Okay.
Leah. Whether you're straight or you're gay mm-hmm. or whatever in between, mm-hmm. Kate was just, like, an awakening. I was mm-hmm. like, who is this woman? She is everything. Mm-hmm. Like, she is not only just transcendently beautiful in this movie, but, mm-hmm. like, she is so excellent. Like, her acting is so insanely strong. Like, mm-hmm. it almost, I mean, the Leo craze, I feel like, kind of, like, swept her incredible star power away, because I guess there's not much of, like, a young, screamy female fandom at that time around Kate Winslet. Mm-hmm. But I'm just so struck by her whenever I see this. Like, she's, it's weird because she's kind of the straight man, but there's so much, like, boiling under, where she's kind of goofy when she's trying to be proper, and then when she, like, lets loose in steerage, ugh, it's too much.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny because I think this is the first movie that I've ever seen her in. I missed the Sense and Sensibility boat, so I didn't see that until about maybe 7 or 8 years ago. And when the Oscar stuff started and she talked in her original accent, I was like, holy hell, this girl's English? What? my mind was blown. I was like, she's the best actress ever, because I didn't know that. And I think it works. She's real. The character, I don't think, gets a lot of attention in terms of James Cameron's oeuvre of women, because you know, I know it's easy to kind of disparage, like Sarah Connor's transition from, like, bouffanted blonde 80s girl to serious soldier woman. But if you look at that same lens towards Rose as a character and how Kate Winslet plays it, I think it's probably the perfect the perfect way to get what you might have thought you were missing from the Terminator movies, because she starts out as this very prim, sophisticated female character who is like, I only care about shoes and doing what I'm supposed to as a society lady. And then as she transforms, she becomes this character that is believable as like an action hero. Because if you think about it, you know, she's willing to go down into this like sunken bottom level to go save Jack and wear this big heavy coat, which I'm sure just like killed Kate Winslet. She's wielding an axe. Mm-hmm. You know, she's like punching people, all this stuff. And you realize how much of a nice gradual progression that's been. It doesn't feel abrupt when it happens. It plays as like a survival instinct, but you could also argue that it's, you know, she's compelled by love. Like, no, she has a moral code and she knows that it's wrong. So I don't think the character gets enough credit for how well transitioned that dichotomy is.
Mm-hmm.
And like the thing that seems to keep giving her this inner strength is just that she is so seen by the person that she is in love with. Like I love how often like Cameron puts those words in Jack's mouth where he's like recognizing, not like first when she kind of says, oh, you must think I'm a poor little rich girl or something, and then he responds with, I'm just wondering like what must have happened to make her think she had no way out. And just that moment of kind of realizing like the complexity of her terrors and fears and her own psychology, it's like that's where the empowerment keeps coming from. Mm-hmm. That she, it was already in her, but like it being continually reinforced, I don't know, like at every single turn in the film,
he's a mirror, and he and he shows exactly what we already see that she's feeling and she's experiencing. Right. And that's sort of the genius of his character, even though it's like, this is a little mansplainy. He really is just her mirror.
Yeah.
And
a beautiful mirror at that, indeed.
A beautiful mirror.
So there are a lot of other characters in this movie, and they're all wonderful. One hardly knows where to begin. But Leah, it looks like you want to say something. So, oh, God. What's your favorite supporting character?
I don't think that we're gonna get to him.
Okay.
If I don't bring him up.
Okay.
My favorite supporting character is Fabrizio.
Fabrizio.
When he died, I was devastated. I named my hamster after him that year. I love him so
Fabrizio.
Much.
Fabrizio.
Yeah. You can see the Statue of Liberty. Very small, of course. Love him. He was obviously a casualty that had to go by virtue of being the best friend and also of indeterminate Latin origin.
He's the fate. He's about as Italian as Mario.
Yeah.
But yeah, quite liked him, and the method of his demise was really intense.
Yeah. He gets shot, right?
No. Like, he gets shot, and the shots are fired into like where he is, and then the
he gets smushed by the smokestack.
Oh, he gets smushed by the steam thingy.
Pushed. Oh
yeah.
No!
It just falls onto him, and you're like, okay, let's move on now, because clearly
you're like,
Fabrizio
maybe he like dived under the water and missed the smoke. No, he's dead. Okay,
yeah. The only people that are strong enough to swim out of the great forces of the water are obviously Kate and Leo.
Yep.
Fabrizio wasn't strong enough.
Nope. Anyway. Oh my God, beautiful. Kristen, I can guess who yours is, but I'll let you tell us.
I love Victor Garber, who plays Mr. Andrews.
Mr. Andrews.
This was my...
I saw the iceberg, and I see it in your eyes. Oh.
Yeah, this was my first movie that had Victor Garber in it. And then I watched Alias, and then I decided that he needed to marry my mom, and then we could go to Prague and have spy adventures together. So I still call him my other dad, even though I know that that's never going to happen. Unless he's listening and he wants to take, you know, my mother. I'm totally okay with him becoming my new father.
Oh my God.
So I think he's so great in this movie, because he's the one character, you know, we see a lot of movies nowadays kind of be like, oh, book learning and education sucks. It's all about, you know, metal and brawn and physicality. He's kind of that character, because he's the one character that knows the boat like the back of his hand and has been telling people how to make it safe. You know, he wanted to put more boats on the deck, but they said it would look too cluttered, so it couldn't do it. And then he said he has all these ideas, and nobody listens to him until the like until things start falling apart. And then he has that great moment where he's saying, you know, that it's gonna sink, and you have mm-hmm. stupid Ismay who's like, but it can't. He's like, she's made of iron, I assure you she can. And I'm like, why do we not listen to this man? He's dapper in a coat, he's awesome as hell, and he seems to know what he's talking about.
And mm-hmm. so paternal. He's sorry, I'm sorry I didn't build you a better ship, young girl.
And that's where I'm just like a sobbing mess. When she comes back and she's like, aren't you gonna try? And he's like, no. And then he just like fixes the clog, and I'm just like, I would come back for you, Victor Gerber. I'm sorry, Leo, but I feel like he's more important. So yeah, he is the unsung hero, I think, of the movie, because he, at every turn, he's just kind of like there as the angelic character. Like, he tells Rose how to get down to steerage, he has the lifebelt, you know, he has all these things, and you don't want him to go. Why, Victor Gerber? Why?
Yeah. I mean, we didn't actually talk about the sort of Titanic as metaphor, right? It's sort of the embodiment of hubris and, as you say, kind of brawn and steel and masculinity. And it's the biggest ship ever.
I love that line that Rose has.
Totally. Preoccupation with size, right? Yeah.
I think it is an anachronism, because I don't think Freud had actually written anything yet.
Oh.
Yeah, but either
way, I mean, you don't like you mean that a Monet didn't also go down on the Titanic?
Yeah. All of the world's greatest art was lost on the Titanic.
Oh well. But I mean, it was too good not to include. But yeah, he is kind of Mr. Andrews is the sort of the counterpoint to all that, right? The smart, sensitive, measured Mr. Andrews. Beautiful grip, Victor Garber. Okay, Emily.
I also love Victor Garber, and I could have I can agree with all of those points about how great he is, but that would just be boring. So my other favorite supporting character is actually Billy Zane, who
Your friend Billy Zane!
Yep. Just the ultimate Ayn Rand kind of self-made man. You know, like, he's a great villain. He's perfect in his self-interested, completely pig-headed maleness, who actually stands for, you know, all of these things about, oh, the ship can't sink, it's big and perfect, just like I am, just like everything that I stand for is right, just like everything that I do proves that I'm, you know, I have no shame in being a complete and total asshole all the time. I just think he kind of plays that villain to a T, even to the moment where he gets on a lifeboat because he grabs a little girl, and you think, like, when he sees a little girl, you think, wait, are we gonna actually see him have a heart? No, that's not what it's about at all. It's about his own self-interest, and he just goes through with it to the very end.
I mean, I think he's a great villain. I remember Cameron gave an interview about how he doesn't want the villain of the film to be kind of a mustache twirler. So he wanted a two-dimensional, or he wanted a three-dimensional villain, right? And I've heard people say that they think that he's like comic book evil. But I completely disagree. Like, I think that all of his actions are completely motivated. We understand that psychology.
Oh yeah, right?
Yeah, a completely familiar kind of like bravado that masks like the deep cowardice. Which is like even what comes back at the very end when we find out, like, oh, you know, crash of 29, like he lost his millions, killed himself. Like, what a fitting end for a character driven by such like paranoia about his money and like women.
It's the toxic masculine pattern that of course a feminist director like James Cameron would have to have toxic
masculine. Of course, yeah. So deliberate that James Cameron.
It's so funny because for me, like, there's kind of two. I have a very distinct type when it comes to dudes, and they all have like an air of like they could be an asshole. And I think it all comes back to Billy Zane and, like, Jeremy Irons. Those are the two that young Kristen, like, lost her mind over.
They messed you up, huh?
Yeah, oh, yeah. This and the Lolita audiobook, like, really screwed me over. And so you watch this, and I always see Cal as a character not too far removed from, like, Chris Sarandon in The Princess Bride. That kind of, that overly confident, like, I know I'm awesome, I buy what I own type of things. And, you know, there's an air of buffoonery to him that's very subtle. Like, watching him slip on that piece of, like, statuary in this movie is hilarious, because he shows that he's not as in control of things as he would like. And what's funny is I actually had, there was a huge Titanic script book that they put out that had the original script, which, spoiler, was actually longer. And there's a scene in the original script that's not in the movie where at the end of the film, which you see Rose kind of hiding in the steerage from him, and they never reunite. And in the original script, there was a scene where they did reunite. They had this discussion where Rose kind of spells out, like, you don't love me, you love the idea of owning something that's pretty. And I think it was a wise move to take it out, because he's a character that there is no talking to him. You know, there's no, like, we're equals in this. He's very, if anything, I think he's the character that represents the time period that the movie is situated in. You know, Jack kind of exists in this modern day 1997 world of, like, I understand women. Cal is what 1914 men were like, which was, you know, you shut your mouth or you get a slap across the face. So I think Billy Zane is so good in this. He should have had a bigger career, because he's awesome.
And, like, just his handsomeness is so key, because he's not, like, he's just great looking, and he's not really that old. So it's just, like, everything, like, she could so easily just be slotted into this romance, and it could look so good from the outside. That's what makes him so scary and terrible, is how hot he is.
Right.
Well, I think you contrast that with, you know, we talked about, you know, mentioning him picking up the child and getting onto the boat. I think that is at least more palatable than the Ismay character, who just gets on the boat because why not? And having read the real Titanic transcripts and her, like, reading the real Ismay try to justify, like, well, there's no one around and I didn't feel the need to, like, tell people there was a boat over here, so I just got on it. And the Ismay character has a mustache. I mean, like, that character, I think, is far more of a nefarious kind of capitalistic representation of, like, men first, than Cal is. Like, Cal, you're like, okay, that little girl is probably an orphan, but at least she lived.
There's a fan fiction somewhere where he raises her and becomes a better man.
Ooh, I'd watch that.
I'll work on it.
There's
some weird, like, Daddy Long Legs type of, like, Fred Astaire, Leslie Caron-esque relationship there.
Oh, God. that movie. Anyway, okay, so just really quickly, I feel like there are a couple more characters that I just need to mention. I'm glad Ismay's getting some love, because I love that actor. But also, we gotta talk, especially Kristen, Miss Unsinkable Molly Brown. That's Kathy Bates.
Yes, which is funny, because how do you feel she compared to Debbie Reynolds?
Her character made more sense to me.
Yeah.
Right? I bought her as a human, right? And she kind of kills it at the end when she's crying. You know, what kind of man are? What was the line?
It's something.
Those are your men out there, Don.
Men out there.
Yeah, those are your men out there. Yes.
which is funny, because you and I talked about Unsinkable Molly Brown after Debbie Reynolds passed, and I had never seen that movie before, and watching it and then watching this, you know, Unsinkable Molly Brown with Debbie Reynolds is great at the song and dance, and she's very cute, and she's got this, like, fire fiery Spitfire Texas twang to her, but at the same time, it's this, it's presented as a like a Paul Bunyan mythic type of character. There's no real nuance to the performance. You know, it's just watching Debbie Reynolds sing and dance, which is delightful, mm-hmm. but you don't really feel like you learn anything about Molly Brown that you didn't already know. And the Titanic scene is literally just kind of inserted. She was on it. Mm-hmm. And she,
oh, by the way, yeah.
By the way, the Titanic. Yeah. Whereas Kathy Bates is slotted in very nicely. You know, she's looked down on because she's new money. She seems to have this somewhat symbiotic relationship with her husband that she mentions very briefly. And she takes charge when things go bad. The only thing is that we don't get any kind of like send off moment for her. She just kind of disappears into the night.
Sure.
But I mean, I can understand why it got so much attention come Oscar time. It's that big showy Kathy Bates has had her due. We should reward her for playing a you know, real life person. I do think it's better than Debbie Reynolds. I love Debbie, but I like the character better here.
Indeed. Yeah, so much she lends her so much pathos and like both like humor and pathos. Like I think she's really effective in both roles when she needs to be. And then who else are we missing?
Wait, but I mean yeah. also yeah. Kathy Bates or Molly Brown.
Yes.
She is like one of the seminal like feminist presences.
That's
for
true.
Rose
yes.
As well.
Yes.
I mean, if again James Cameron,
right.
feminist filmmaker, mm-hmm. was trying to make some statements with like every iteration of woman on the mm-hmm. Titanic, like
mm-hmm. right. Yeah.
She really galvanizes a lot of like Rose's transformation,
absolutely.
Even indirectly.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's true that like Jack wasn't the only impetus for her transformation, right? Like she needed a female to model mm-hmm. The sort of lifestyle that she would want to emulate. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When her sitting at the table in first class, I feel like Rose, that's like one of the beginning moments when Rose starts to see,
mm-hmm.
you know, like
mm-hmm.
alternate paths.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's directly contrasted with her mother,
Who
I think, oh God, what's her name? Come on.
Isn't it like
Frances Fisher?
Frances Fisher, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Who is also wonderful.
Absolutely phenomenal.
Oh my God. She's kind of the, perhaps the unsung hero of the movie. Perhaps.
Explain.
Well, I don't know. Like, that's such an unlikable character, right? It's such a throwaway role, right? Like, this is the mother that's holding her daughter back from a life of happiness, right? But she sells that character, right? She makes, I mean, we haven't really talked about the dialogue,
well,
and we'll get there.
I think
she sells it.
I think the mom character in this film, and I say the same thing about Billy Zane, which is he represents the era that Jack and mm-hmm. Rose are kind of played up as what we want modern characters to be like, but whereas Cal and her mother are very representative of the era that they're in. But I think that's why a scene like the corset tying scene is so necessary, because mm-hmm. you know, you understand from her mother's perspective what, God, I hate to say James Cameron feminist director, but he kind of is.
I really hate this.
You know, she reiterates and lays out very bluntly what men have done, which is, you know, her husband hid their debts under a good name, and the fact that they have this name is the only thing they have to keep them afloat, and that as much as I think it pains her, she has to have her daughter marry to keep their lifestyle and the way of life, the only way of life that if we're looking at women in the early 1900s, the only way of life that she's probably ever known, which is transitioning from her father's house to her husband's house, you know, mm-hmm. to her to have none of that, that's unthinkable. That is the most terrifying thing in existence. So mm-hmm. I think you understand her motivations as much as you don't want to. That scene is so necessary because it's the one moment of like, okay, I understand. I don't agree with it, but I understand for the time period why it has to be that way.
And all of that hovers under the surface, and we really could have done without. Of course, it's unfair. We're women.
Yes.
Like, okay. Thank you.
I
got it.
I was gonna say that,
underline that a little bit.
That is the redemptive moment where you're like, okay, of course it's unfair. We're women.
Which I think we're still. That, That's gonna be like etched on all of our tombstones at some point.
Of course, it's unfair. We're women. Okay. All right.
Out of any movie.
What?
That's the line that should never be left out of any movie. Of course, it's unfair.
That's absolutely true. Yeah. All the movies from now
on.
You
can literally see that in Alien. You can see it. Like it's anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Indeed. Well, I've teased this long enough. We should totally talk about the dialogue in this movie. Emily, you sort of identified this as the film's primary flaw. Is it a flaw? I ask you.
I won't let go.
You will not let go of this?
It's a flaw.
Okay. All right. Why? What is it about it that's... why is it... I mean... But it doesn't really sink the movie, if you will.
There are so many lines that just make it count in such a repetitive way that I started counting them, how many times they said the same line. make it count three times.
Make it count. You jump.
I jump. Is that three times? Maybe four.
There's a lot of trailer lines, I think, where you can painfully point out what lines would have played really well in a trailer.
When the ship docks, I'm getting off with you. And maybe the most controversial, to everyone, Titanic was the ship of dreams, but to me, it was a slave ship taking me back to America.
Oh, yeah.
Rose. Okay, all right. Okay.
There's some kitschiness, some cheesiness. I'm the king of the world, Jack. I'm flying. And then there's some real, like, just hard hitting grotesqueness, like this slave ship one. And then, of course, there's the state the theme right on the nose, right on the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer nose. A woman's heart is a deep ocean of secrets.
There it is.
It's so beautiful. What do you mean?
I mean, like, but it's true. But, I love bad dialogue.
Yeah!
The bad dialogue gives you an easier access point because there's so much complexity going on in every other corner of the movie. I feel that, like, you know, it's kind of like elided by the fact that it's like, you know, big romantic spectacle, but like you kind of forget like how much visual information you're getting at every single moment, how the structure is so complex and kind of does like push the envelope of the blockbuster. Like I kind of feel like the dialogue does have to be kind of bad and cheesy, and like it's deliberate. It's not like, you know, aged poorly by time, although it has.
Where I keep the concept of, you know, James Cameron. I don't think any of us would say James Cameron's ever been a good screenwriter. You know, you look at some of the lines of dialogue.
Never been a great dialogue.
You look at some of the lines of dialogue in, you know, the Terminator movies. You know, anything Edward Furlong says in Terminator 2 is just like abominable.
Right.
And I think when James Cameron is trying to write sappy kind of expository romantic dialogue, he flounders, to use more sea metaphors. But when he's actually showing like the research that he did into the time period and the ship itself, I think some of it's really good. You know, like not to tout out, you know, the Victor Garber lines, I think a lot of his lines are probably my favorite because they're emphasizing the ship first, which is what James Cameron is really interested in. You know, some of the wordless scenes, I think, especially at the end, where we're actually seeing him as a screenwriter, I think are really good. You know, like Isadora and Ida Strauss on the bed. Or the little Irish woman reading Tirmanog to her kids. Like, those scenes are really good. James Cameron, like, screenwriter. Like, that's where I think he's interested. As opposed to kind of, like, I gotta write about these two schmucks, you know, spouting sissy love dialogue to each other. Like, he just really doesn't know what to do with that.
That is like, that's literally the George Lucas problem. Like, I love you, I know, is not, that is not a good exchange. Mm-hmm. It is not.
Well,
like,
he didn't
good.
Write that, right? Harrison Ford came up with the I know. Right?
Okay, yeah. Well, maybe that's made it iconic.
Plus,
like,
it's never it's... having to say you're sorry mentality.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, but do you feel like a sucker for investing in the relationship? Because I do. I mean, I don't feel like a sucker, but I definitely invest in the relationship. I care. But I also think it's because the actors are able to take this dialogue and give it life. And again, I don't think it's not realistic dialogue. He's definitely, you're right. He's writing in sound bites, you know, and it does not bother me. Right. Because I think the whole idea of this romance is kind of silly. Like I don't, this didn't happen.
It's the Casablanca thing. It's literally sure, the embodiment yeah. of Humphrey Bogart being like, the problems of you and I amount to
yeah,
nothing
yeah.
or little beans compared to, like, the ship is sinking.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It knows that.
Yeah.
Like, my absolute favorite Jack line is when they're at the staircase and then he kisses her hand and then he says, when he says, I saw that in a Nickelodeon once and I always wanted to do that. Yeah. Like, that is such a great line because it just shows, like, this is, like, a little, like, insane. Mm-hmm. Like, this love story doesn't belong here. Like, this is such a construction. Mm-hmm. But that's what's charming about a lot of those lines. Like, mm-hmm. we're supposed to, like, memorialize them and speak them to each other and have them on our lunchboxes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then there's the lines that don't sound great on paper. And then when you hear Kate Winslet deliver them, you're like, yes. I think we're running a little bit late here. So I just really quickly, give me a recitation of your favorite line. Who wants to start? Emily, will you do the honors?
Oh, I've already said so many lines.
Have you?
I don't know.
I mean, there's just so many to choose
she
from,
them
though.
In so
yeah.
cleverly.
But you have to do it with the full, you know, the full weight of the full emotional weight behind it. I want to hear it.
I'll never let go.
Nice. Well, I'm crying. Yeah. All right, Kristen.
My favorite line the entire movie is it's a Victor Garber line because why not? It's when he tells her, you remember what I told you about the boats. That scene is like terrifying. That's like heart stopping to me because you're like, holy crap, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, all right, Leah.
Mine is actually following Kate Winslet exclamation.
I know what ice fishing is.
Tell her what ice fishing is as she's about to kill herself. It's just so good. Beautiful.
Yeah. Oh my god. Again, I think I gotta go with Kate on this. I think I gotta go with, I'd rather be his whore than your wife.
Yeah.
Oh good. Oh yes. Good. Oh. Or you unimaginable bastard.
Which I still used mostly to refer to, like, good looking guys. I'm like, you unimaginable
you
bastard.
Unimaginable
you were too
bastard.
Perfect. Stop it.
It's beautiful. Okay. Okay, we do need to talk about this. Much of the I don't know, a lot of, like, the public enthusiasm has kind of diminished, I would say. Certainly at the time, there was this enormous media circus surrounding the release of this film and the production of this film, the release of the film, the release of the VHS set. And then suddenly, I don't know, as a 9-year-old, I sort of got the sense that the tides were turning.
I wonder, I'm always fascinated by how this movie would have played in a world with social media. Because I think what's important to remember is that we didn't have the proliferation of the internet at this point. So it was all, you know, print media, radio, and TV and movies. So I don't remember being inundated with Titanic imagery from those avenues. I got the sheer amount of it after it had come out, and it was slowly, I think they did like a platform release and they slowly rolled it out to theaters. And you get that backlash with any movie that is kind of beloved. We saw that with last year with La La Land. You know, people were really excited about La La Land. I will tell you, I was really excited about La La Land. And then I saw it and I was like, well, this movie's not that good. And I mean, the fact that this movie is still holds the record as one of the three movies to win the most Academy Awards of all time. And I think people want to, there's always that concept of, well, it didn't deserve this or it didn't deserve that. It's one of the highest grossing movies, I think, of all time still. And by that token, I think it's just the concept of it's the biggest. And I think part of it is gendered, because James Cameron has now come back around to making these visually atmospheric, patently male movies. I think a lot of what he's, you know, to kind of go with what we said about Leo, I think he's been kind of paying for Titanic with a lot of his work, kind of showing that he is, you know, not the sappy love guy. He's making these, you know, Fern Gully meets Pocahontas in space movies now, or whatever the hell Avatar is. So I think that a lot of the criticism is just the sheer how massive it was from a advertising perspective, where we had so few ways to avoid it, and the general malaise that kind of comes from seeing that this is the big awards darling. It's probably the biggest awards darling of our modern history.
It is unfortunate that Titanic will it'll just always be remembered as like the most bloated chick flick of all time, which is not, I mean, it's a fine example of epic movie making, you know, but like the chick flick label is so toxic, and yet I love them.
Yeah.
Well,
so I mean, Cameron's the one who labeled it a chick flick, right?
Yeah.
Well,
what were you gonna say, Emily?
Well, we didn't talk a whole lot about the second half of the movie, which is the disaster movie part, and that is something. Even to, you know, today I rewatched this movie. It is quite traumatic to watch.
Yeah.
Not. It's anxiety producing. It's not something that it's easy for teenage girls or anyone to watch. And for that to be such an overlooked part, it is a dramatic love story with cheesy dialogue and a lot of complex character relationships, but it also makes this, you know, epic disaster, something that is totally real and believable. And that is something that often does not get recognized at awards ceremonies, you know, being able to make a disaster movie that
a romance disaster movie. I was trying to think what else is even in that genre besides like Dante's Peak.
Yeah. Also with Linda Hamilton.
Yeah. But that is such a feat to make a romance disaster film.
Yeah. It sort of stands alone in that regard. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's also part of what we've been talking about is like the dramatization of history and what is the responsibility of the filmmaker when attempting to do that. And the way James Cameron uses this device to both talk about the emotional lives of the survivors and the people who died, and also, well, in terms of their interpersonal relationships, but also about how harrowing that experience must have been and how terrifying it must have been, right? And it really does just make it come alive.
I do want to throw out real quick that I think the movie that James Cameron's going for with the romantic disaster movie is, if anybody's seen it, it's from 1936. It's called San Francisco. It's got Clark Gable and Jeanette McDonald, and it's essentially, I'll read you the plot. Clark Gable plays a nightclub owner who hires a singer. They two hit it off and become romantically involved, but she is soon courted by a real estate magnate to sing at the Tivoli Opera House, and then the earthquake in San Francisco hits. I think that's kind of what he's going for there.
Yeah, so not unprecedented, but it was from 1930.
That's true. So we hadn't really seen that. So
yeah. There's I mean, there were other Titanic. There are other renderings of the disaster, right? And I think, you know, the Stanwyck one is a total melodrama. And I think it's been a long time, but isn't she going through like a divorce or something like that? Remind me.
I haven't seen that one yet. I need to.
Oh, you haven't seen it? Okay. Okay. Well, yeah, I think that it wasn't the first to sort of incorporate a love story, but I think it's the best one, right? I think it just totally stands alone.
Yes.
Okay, and just let's start to wrap things up. Let's go around and talk about whether or not it's worthy of inclusion in the FlixWise favorites list, which, duh. But also, let's just talk about the legacy of Titanic. Do you think this will be remembered in another 20 years? And if so, in what light, right? Is it the launching pad of Kate and Leo? Is it where that annoying song comes from, which not annoying at all? Shut up. Or, I mean, will it be remembered as a great work of cinema? Or whatever. I mean, you know, those are just options. You can have another take.
You could go with the cynical, like, children will still be flummoxed, the Titanic was a real thing. Or the conspiracy theory of whether Rose dies or not at the end of this film. Which there should be none. She does. Okay.
She definitely does.
Yes.
She definitely does. Why are we arguing this point? Yeah. Stop it. Yeah. No, I think in all seriousness, we will be talking about it in another 20 years. I think it'll be in the same vein, and I hate to say this because it makes me feel so old. I think it'll be in the same vein as something like a Spartacus or, you know, kind of a Dr. Zhivago, this old movie that harkens back to, you know, I think we look at it in terms of, oh, trying to harken back to the golden era, and there will be another generation of, you know, young adults who will see it and think, well, that's how people in the weird 90s were making movies back when they had, like, no money. So I think in by film history standards, I mean, again, it is one of the three movies to win the most awards. It's one of the highest grossing films of all time. So from a historical standpoint in film cinema history, I mean, it definitely has to be remembered. I don't think it'll be one of those, like, I don't remember Titanic. I think it's still so ubiquitous in the zeitgeist that people will remember it.
I hope so. Emily, what do you think?
Well, of course I'm going to say yes for inclusion in the FlixWise favorites list, since I did nominate it. and I think actually it's starting to be long enough that people can forget all of, or not forget, but that people could let go of some of these preconceptions that they have of the movie. And hopefully in another 20 years, it will be something that people who have seen it can revisit and rediscover the way I didn't expect to find it be a great classic movie 20 years later. So I think there's going to be some element of rediscovery of Titanic.
Sure hope so. Leah?
This movie will be remembered for the rest of human history.
Yes, thank you.
FlixWise favorites needs it.
Yes.
For me, coming at it from a little bit of maybe like a more media studies angle, what I think part of Titanic's biggest legacy is the way it brought post-production to the forefront of movie making. How kind of epic and seismic the reaction was to the verisimilitude of, like, the actual, like, ship cracking and, like, the scale of it, how the ocean looked real. It wasn't, like, all the, like, extras didn't have faces and pose. Like, everything looked so real, and that was thanks to the magic of 90s computers.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it was just this big moment where we really were able to see history being so alive in a way that it wasn't before. It wasn't the kind of CGI, like, visual spectacle that you would see in a sci-fi movie. It was being applied to this very real, very tragic, large-scale situation. And I feel like it kind of signaled, you know, all of our hubris since to be able to recreate these big moments in human history. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe I'm overstating, but I'm not.
No, not at all. Not even a little.
Yeah.
It's the Titanic.
You can never go back once you've seen the actual Titanic sinking and been like, wow, that is so actually real and happening.
Yep. I guess sort of in that vein, I do think that this film is sort of it's very emblematic of the time, right? Especially the characterization of Jack Dawson, but it's also anomalous, right? It's so few directors get an opportunity to make something, to get this amount of money to make this vision come to life, right? And so I just think that because it is such a kind of curiosity, I do think people will return to it. And as Leah mentioned, it was sort of on the forefront of this CGI technology. And there are a couple of shots here or there where you really do see the seams show a little bit, right? Like as the stern goes up, I think it's the stern, we can kind of see that it's a computer effect, right? But just the use of practical effects and the sets and the scale, I think, is unparalleled, and it has not been replicated since. And the sense that you're actually there, and that this that you get kind of really do get a sense of the scope of the disaster, and what it must have been like for the people on board that ship. I think it's kind of perfect. And we haven't really talked about Cameron as visual stylist, but above all, beyond feminist director, I think that's really where he shines. He's a great director of action. The man knows where to put the camera. And this, along with, I would say, Aliens, are probably his two masterpieces. And I think they're both great films. And I really do hope that people return to them. Plus, I mean, it's the kind of, it's the birth of the Kate and Leo phenomenon, right? Like, let us not discount that. I say we put it in the FlixWise favorites list. What do you guys think?
Done it.
Yay! Okay. And that's the way we frame it. FlixWise, that is. Listeners, I know you have thoughts on Titanic, and I want to hear them. Go leave us a comment on our website, FlixWise.com. Or you can leave us a message on our Facebook page at facebook.com/FlixWise. And if you're interested in holding a memorial service for Rose's beautiful pink coat, you should probably come follow me on Twitter. We'll organize something. R.I.P. So beautiful. So beautiful. So young.
Let's not forget the Monet that we lost, too. Okay?
And the Monet. And the Monet. So much loss. You know? but before you do all of that, please, please save me in every way that a podcaster can be saved. Go to iTunes or your podcatcher of choice, subscribe, rate us, leave us a nice comment. And if you don't, there's only so much space on this door, so make the right call, people. Make the right call. We didn't really talk about that. It's for the best. Okay, on our next show, I think we have our 2017 in review episode. This year, the planets do a bunch of listener lists and call-in stuff. So if you have a top five drafted, or if you have any thoughts you'd like to share, get at me on the social medias, or you can email me at info@flixwise.com. Until then, Emily, thanks for giving us your pitch and for finally coming on the show.
Yes, it has been so wonderful. I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you so much for staying up so late. It's like 3:30 in the morning where Emily is. She's in Berlin, so it's FYI. Right. It's commitment. Kristen? I can't think of no better reason to stay up until 3:30. Kristen? I can't believe this is your first time on the show. How is that possible?
I know. You will just That's have to ridiculous. Have me back to talk about more of my weird childhood sure things. If you ever talk about Lolita, I can talk about that movie.
I'm pretty sure that'll come up. Done. All right, Leah. I do believe that is your cue. Listeners, we have a special treat.
It's really special.
It's real special. We have live musical accompaniment.
Guys, it's beautiful. I broke out my flute from high school marching band. And I just feel like we really need it to set the mood. So,
all right, here we go.
I'll lead us in.
Okay, you ready? Are you guys ready to sing?
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah, let's hear it. Do you know the words? Pull up those lyrics. It's happening. It is happening. Okay, you ready?
Are you ready? Oh,
let's do it.
So nervous. Oh, it's been so long. Okay.
My heart will go on and on.